everybody, and welcome back to another week at the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. Big show planned for you, and I'm just going to stretch for a couple more seconds.
Because I'm not
And
ready.
Here's Brooke. Because I could see that she was doing something with her clothing.
Of
I don't know.
Tape, and we just discussed this, right? And
so I decided to smoothly gloss
you did,
over it.
And it was nice, but I had a piece of tape, and it came undone right as he was talking. I think I hadn't like put it down tight enough, so I was trying to fix it.
Yeah. It's a big problem,
you
tape.
Know.
But anyway, you're here, and that's good because we have got a lot to talk about today.
Yeah, and I'm dressed like you.
You actually, yes, John we're dressed very similar. We should have worn the same shirt. We'll coordinate next week.
It's all right.
But look, over the course of the next hour, we got a lot that we're going to talk about. Donald Trump gave a speech on Saturday, trafficked in some of the most just blatant anti-Semitic tropes. So we're going to talk about that. But also, spending in the Democratic primary shifting rapidly, especially with one candidate's spending patterns. And then later on, Joe Biden, what does he think should happen in the 2020 election? Not going to be surprised to have revealed that he wants to win, but he doesn't necessarily want it to go the way that you might imagine. And then Pete Buttigieg, his fundraising, he doesn't want you to know much about it. And the way that he's communicating around this issue is, I think, a bit self-destructive. So we'll talk about that.
A one-word answer be considered communicating? I just want to be clear, because
technically.
Yeah, okay, so that's a word, okay.
Or I should have said, no, and then walked off the stage. Ah, that's a spoiler alert. But anyway, before you get all of that, why don't we touch base with Donald Trump and how he spent his weekend. Donald Trump this Saturday gave a speech at the Israeli-American Council National Summit in Florida. And he said a lot of things, but one thing in particular stood out. Let's watch this video and see if you can guess what it is.
A lot of you are in the real estate business because I know you very well. You're brutal killers. Not nice people at all, but you have to vote for them. You have no choice. You're not going to vote for Pocahontas, I can tell you that. You're not going to vote for the wealth tax. Yeah, let's take 100% of your wealth away. No, no. Even if you don't like me, some of you don't. Some of you I don't like at all, actually. And you're going to be my biggest supporters because you'll be out of business in about 15 minutes if they get it. So I don't have to spend a lot of time on that.
So in more reasonable times, perhaps him declaring a prominent Democratic primary candidate, Pocahontas, again, even though he's been told many times from people inside and outside of the Native American community that's entirely unacceptable and offensive, he did it. Let's maybe gloss over the fact that that crowd laughed at that. That's an indictment of them as well, not just Trump. He can make the comment, it should be to a quiet room. There should be crickets and nothing else after he makes that comment, but that's not even the worst thing. It was the, you guys are in the real estate business, you wanna make some money, you hate me, you don't support me, but there's no way you're gonna vote for a wealth tax, obviously, because it's only money that's motivating your political activity.
So taking away where he was and who he was talking to, that is what happened with a lot of people. Those are the same people still swearing that, not those people in the room, but I'm saying, people who voted for Trump regardless of all of the racism. And this isn't his first time being anti-Semitic, but this is not new. And it was like, well, I'm not racist. I was just okay with it. And now he's just running with it. He's like, yeah, it happened before. Now I'm gonna say it directly to you and I'm gonna disrespect you.
Yeah.
And hope that nobody watching cares.
Yeah. Or think that even if they care, even if you people in the audience, even if you get that I am invoking these anti-Semitic tropes, it doesn't matter because I am so sure that you'll vote for me anyway because of this one fake version of the wealth tax that I'm pretending exists. No version of the wealth tax that Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders are putting forward takes away 100% of your wealth. It is a tiny little percentage over and above $10 or $50 million, depending on which plan you're looking at. So he's lying about the details there, but he really does seem to believe that the fear that there could be additional taxes, if he's in a group of potential voters who are all Jewish, that's the only thing he thinks he needs to talk about.
It's vile. But
yeah, and not surprising.
It's not surprising, right?
I get that. But one of the mission statements of the show is to fight back against the normalization of exactly things like this.
Absolutely, it's vile.
And so he also complained that some Jews, quote, don't love Israel enough. And that's for him to decide. You can look at.
I don't even think he could break that down and explain what he's trying to say by saying that.
I mean, it is this belief that a particular—
No, I don't think he.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's true. Duh. Yes, that's as much of his mind as I can put myself in. But anyway, look, I'm giving my response. I'm not Jewish, it's not for me to respond, but some people are, and they have responded. So the executive director of the Jewish Democratic Council of America, Haley Sofer, said that Trump's deeply offensive remarks, including his unconscionable repeating of negative stereotypes that have been used historically to target Jews, only reinforce our belief that Donald Trump is the biggest threat to American Jews. She also complained that Trump even had the audacity to suggest that Jews had no choice but to support him. She noted an overwhelming majority of Jews are both pro-Israel and anti-Trump because of his incendiary rhetoric and because he's emboldened the rise of white nationalism in America, which has directly led to increased hatred and violence targeting Jews. We also have a comment from author and rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, who said, "It's not even coded anti-Semitism. It's not a dog whistle. He's saying this out loud to a room full of Jews who laugh. White supremacy is a hell of a drug." And J Street, prominent organization, said the president of the United States is incapable of addressing Jewish audiences without dipping into the deep well of anti-Semitic tropes that shape his worldview.
It's true. And I want to push back on something you said, because I know what you meant by saying, you know, I'm not Jewish, it's not my place. I know you mean like, I'm not Jewish, not my place to speak for the Jewish community.
That's what I mean, yes.
But it is our place to speak out, which is what you're doing, which is what this whole segment is. But it is our place to speak out against that, because it's gross and it's awful. And we've got to, you know, we have to. It's our responsibility.
Exactly.
And I wish we stood together more. So I do like to see, I like to log on Twitter and see everybody, at least that I follow, calling this out. You
exactly,
know?
Yeah. The thing is, the fact that it's another week of impeachment hearings and all that, and so much else that happens, that I don't think there's any guarantee that this is going to be a big focus of the news. Even on Monday, the first real news day, I don't know that it'll be talked about much.
It's not new.
No,
and that's
it's
what's
not.
So frustrating. It's, you know, it's still happening.
Yeah, and it would be reassuring a bit if you were one of the Republican congressmen or senators who had big issues with things that, like Representative Ilhan Omar said, you thought that she made some reference that could be interpreted as referencing one of these stereotypes. Well, he's just saying them out loud. And that's where the crickets come in. Not in the room, but from those who say that they care a lot about anti-Semitism on the rise in America. So when he's just saying them out loud, they don't care. When he's emboldening anti-Semitic terrorist groups and domestic groups, they don't care. They don't talk about it at all. It is just a useful thing for them to occasionally mention.
And this is not just deeply offensive. This is why I always say, you know, it's wild that like I'm a journalist who is just not a free speech absolutist. I don't want anybody, I don't think that your words should put you in prison, right? But we have to call out these words, because every absolute disaster, every genocide, everything that has happened in this world that is awful has begun with hate speech. That's how it starts. That's why the guy ran into the synagogue in Pennsylvania, because of hate speech. This is where it starts, and it's already started. There's nothing to start. It's already started. We've already seen what this rhetoric from this man can do.
Yeah.
But
see, I think you don't even, like what you're talking about, you don't need to apologize one bit for that. The only reason I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you feel that you need to explain why you're not a free speech absolutist, what it means, what it doesn't mean, is because disingenuous political actors, almost universally on the right, have so shifted what free speech means.
Tell them, John.
So, like, your right to speech in the Bill of Rights has to do with the government infringing on your free speech. They can't lock you up, they can't do these sorts of things. What the right means is, don't criticize me when I say something terrible. Right. I want to be able to call you a racial slur, and you don't say anything.
Right.
Not that the government's coming in and locking me up. I don't want to be criticized. And if I say a whole bunch of these things, and if someone doesn't want to pay me in the future,
or
then that's infringing on my right to free speech, because I'm not being paid to advance conspiracy theories and hate speech and all of that. That has nothing to do with the Bill of Rights. And I feel like they have really co-opted that language, because they're the only ones that talk about it a lot. They just happen to do it in a 100% self-interested, financially focused perspective.
You're right.
You don't have to apologize for anything.
Thank you. I'll never do it again.
Okay. 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 Really fast. Let's transition. Yeah, exactly. Really fast. Let's transition to this. Democratic primary is starting to heat up, especially financially. So I want to take a look. We're going to touch base with the advertising dollars that have been spent.
Okay.
And it's going to be one of those classic damage report charts that you can't make any sense of, but we'll try to make
sense
of it.
You'll explain.
Let's bring this up. I mostly mean because it's small. But anyway, what you see there is stretching back to the beginning of this year, month by month, how many millions of dollars of, this is airings, but basically it correlates with the spending that's been done. And you can see there that starting in about July, that's when the ads started to really run. And you notice that like greenish, light green color, that's Tom Steyer, billionaire candidate. The best one, but still billionaire candidate. And he is swamping all of the other candidates combined, month after month. At some point, you see Trump in October start to shoot up a bit. And then in about October, you see some pink. That's Bernie Sanders. So month after month, Tom Steyer is spending more than all the other candidates combined until.
Right. Right.
I mean, Michael Bloomberg is literally, you're not hearing me right now because Michael Bloomberg's ad is on instead of us. That's basically what's going on. It's everywhere. He makes Tom Steyer look broke in how many ads he's buying.
And I'm not surprised by Bloomberg. I guess I'm not surprised at all.
He said he'd do it.
Right, and I feel like every time like there's a presidential race, we're always wondering when it's gonna happen, if it's gonna happen, if he's gonna do it this year. But Tom Steyer is fascinating to me because I'm curious as to, like, do you want, is this a lifelong dream? Like, do you want this? Or did it just pop? Like, why not put your money into, like, give it to Cory Booker? Like, create, like, I don't know, like, you know what I mean?
Specifically.
Find a candidate that you like.
Well, that's what they normally do. That's what they normally do.
Put your money there. Why do you have to be on the stage?
I think most billionaires are perfectly happy to try to buy a candidate. I think that some either feel like they've got it or just kind of arrogant. And they're like, you know what? That's too indirect. I'll just do it myself.
Yeah, because that's
look,
a lot of.
Like I said, Tom Steyer, he's probably the best because of those, he's at least running ads around climate change and he seems to take the threat of Trump seriously. Like Michael Bloomberg, we'll analyze some Bloomberg ads in the near future.
I
but
mean, he
his
can
goals
keep
are,
his ads and he could also keep this space that he's taking up that Julian Castro probably should have had in the last debate. Like, do you know what
probably
I mean?
Probably driving like, up like, the ad prices. Yeah, and the big issue here is just, we have a system where a billionaire could come in and say, I'm gonna spend $500 million to $1 billion. And whether you have any interest in me whatsoever, I'm going to spend so much money that we will hire every ad creator, every strategist, and we'll figure out some way not to win the nomination necessarily. I don't think that that's likely to happen, but he'll get on the debate stage. He'll figure out some kind of scam, honestly, like Tom Steyer did, where he's getting donations that they get the money back for. It's this ridiculous scam, and it does push other people out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the state of the Democratic primary. Fun, isn't it?
We're gonna be doing. I was just about to say, yay!
Yay! and this is just the beginning, and we haven't even gotten to a caucus or a primary
yet. It is still 2019.
Yeah, it is. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Guest is gonna be joining us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Hey, Hey there, welcome back to The Damage Report. I am not John Iadarola. I'm Brooke Thomas, but don't worry, he's sitting right next to me. It'll be okay. First up here today, we're going to talk to Rashad Robinson, host of the Voting While Black podcast and president of Color of Change. Rashad, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
I'm glad to have you here. Tell us a little bit about the podcast.
Well, the podcast is an opportunity, and where it's operated through our political action committee, Color of Change PAC. What we wanted to do was invite each of the presidential candidates, whoever would come, to have a conversation, not just about the what in terms of their list of policies and priorities, but the how. Right. The fact of the matter is Black people, Black issues are deeply present, not always in the ways that we want them to be, but they're deeply present on the presidential candidate stage. And candidates are talking about a range of issues and making promises to the community, but oftentimes not talking about how they're going to get it done. And I fundamentally believe, and we fundamentally believe, that there's a huge gap between promising us something and actually being able to talk about how you're going to work with movements, how you will deal with entrenched corporate power, all the barriers to actually making ideas actual reality. And so to the extent that we are spending about 30 minutes each podcast, and with a partnership with Now This, also pushing out videos to really force these candidates to talk about how they're going to make change happen, how they will work with movements and communities, to do it, and what and who and what are the barriers that they will deal with that oftentimes stand in the way of change.
Well, let's talk about that, because you did mention that you have invited some presidential, all presidential candidates, whoever will come. Tell me who has come, and then what type of answers you've gotten as far as direct action and what's going to happen and how this is going to happen when it comes to issues that are important to Black voters.
In terms of the candidates who are currently candidates, we've had Warren, Sanders, Castro, Williamson, Steyer. Harris sat with us before she dropped out, and Mayor Pete. And so, like, to the extent we've had these, each of these candidates, a number of candidates we've had some trouble scheduling with. Some have maybe made it a little more clear that they're not going to join us. But a couple of things have stood out. I think each of the candidates at various points in the interview, I think, had to be pressed on the how. I think these candidates are interested in being able to talk about why they're for Medicaid for all, or Medicare for all, or being able to talk about why they care about criminal justice. But when we start to push them on, okay, so how are you going to get that to happen? How will you get that to happen inside of a Mitch McConnell-led Senate, if that's what actually happens? How will you get that to happen? Because some of these proposals that these candidates are pushing are way more advanced than, let's say, what President Obama had put on the table. But we saw all the pushback that President Obama got for proposals that may not even be as progressive as the things we want today. And so what are you going to do different than President Obama did in terms of dealing with the factions that will stand in the way? We also, in each of these conversations, the final question, I've asked them all the same final question. And so, you know, every presidential election season, candidates come, in particular this season, they've come to our community and they talk about the issues, they talk about disparities. I think all of that is important in terms of being able to recognize how far the movement has come in pushing certain issues that maybe we never dreamed would be debated on the presidential stage, like reparations and other things. But I'm also not just asking these candidates what they're going to do for the Black community, but each of the final questions, each of the candidates, I've asked them, Black people have contributed so much to America, to service, to where we see the country moving forward. Who is a Black person that has contributed to your understanding of politics and service? To force these candidates to also talk about who are the Black people in their lives that they listen to, that have helped them understand issues, that they follow. That for us is also critically important to being able to separate people who have had an experience and a relationship with the community and those that may not, because that will also determine how successful these candidates are at delivering for us, those that actually have a rooted understanding and history with the community.
Good morning, Rashad. This is John. I wanted to ask you about a couple of different things, but you actually just really piqued my curiosity there. So when the candidates were answering those questions about who would inspire them, who had they learned from, you've spoken now with several of them. Who would you say gave very convincing or authentic responses to that? And who tripped your alarm as being a little bit shallower in their response in that area?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I was, you know, I really appreciated Secretary Castro's answer. He talked specifically about a local minister activist who was friends with his mom, who ended up running for office and winning office in San Antonio, and what that meant from activism to leadership. He also mentioned Jesse Jackson and being, preteens. And while Jesse Jackson was running for president and coming from an activist home, and what that meant to see a multiracial coalition coming together, it was an answer that I think could really resonate with a lot of folks. Elizabeth Warren talked about Congressman Elijah Cummings, and we actually did the interview before Congressman Cummings passed away. And she specifically talked about the year she had worked with him on financial reform before she was an elected official, and how much he had pushed her on what it meant to fight and to stand up and push back, pushing her around being an academic and what it meant to like be deeply connected to communities, and connecting her to many of the people that had suffered under some of the systems she was pushing back on in his home of Baltimore. Sanders talked about his time working with CORE and King, and he mentioned Belafonte. And then there were folks who I think, mentioned people who were that they knew, like Mayor Pete, maybe didn't talk about how that impacted issues they understood or how it sort of informed their work today. I think it was an answer that each of the candidates were surprised to get at the end, even as we started to signal. But I do think that for each of them, what I was hoping to do was push these candidates to think more broadly about how they engage with the community, how they listen to the community, and what they're going to put on the table. You know, we're still waiting on someone like Cory Booker to agree to join us. Biden, we basically have gotten sort of a no, but who knows there. And then we've had people that have been sort of surprising at not joining us. Well, I would say Booker was a bit surprising, but you know, every time we reach out to Klobuchar, they sort of direct us to their head of African American outreach. And someone who's polling at 0% with African American South Carolina, you would think that they would be interested in doing the podcast. And engaging around some of these issues, especially engaging with organizations like ours, which has been so out front on tech accountability and tech policy. That's been one of the issues where she's really, I think, shined. And so it's unfortunate that she doesn't have a strong enough kind of theory around Black outreach yet for a Color of Change to be an organization that she feels that she has to meet with or even do our podcast at all. I will say that our season finale was with Kamala Harris. And I will say that she dropped out maybe the next week and maybe she was a little bit freer, but I found it to be one of the most engaging conversations I've had with Senator Harris in some time. And I felt like she really dug in to try to talk about her prosecutor record. But I felt like she may have been the strongest on tech accountability, and she went deep on algorithmic bias and a bunch of other situations in terms of corporate power. And it was actually something I had not heard from her before, and after she dropped out, had wished that maybe we had heard more of that Kamala Harris earlier on in the campaign, and it could have maybe done more to help folks see a fuller picture of her candidacy, even though there were a lot of unanswered questions about her record on criminal justice and questions that she and I had, in private conversations, had asked her to address more quickly.
So Rashad, we have completely run out of time, but I do want to ask one more question. I want to show our viewers a picture here. It's a graphic that shows the distribution of white voters in presidential elections, and it like very clearly shows that Democrats haven't won over white voters in decades. Black voters are hardcore Democrats. Black women have widely been considered the backbone of the Democratic Party. And just kind of touching on what you just mentioned about Senator Klobuchar, and also I think how the media as a whole, and as a member of the media, I feel fine criticizing like how we work, and presidential candidates often have to be like dragged into talking about the issues of the people who are the most loyal. Why do you think that is?
I think that there's some magical thinking about how elections are won, mm-hmm. And how elections are won for Democrats. And that magical thinking is like that there's some magical white baits of people that if we just convince them that they'll come. I think there's a magical thinking about how Obama won in 08 and in 12, when in 12, you know, black people outpaced all others in terms of actual turnout. And so you had these sort of super majority of black engagement that actually overrode some of the ways in which he lost white voters. And because Hillary Clinton didn't have that, she wasn't able to overcome some of the other challenges. And so to the extent that searching for sort of voters who have made it clear that they don't want you and ignoring those that have gotten you to the party is the quickest way for this for us to lose. It also sort of goes against the idea of what we need to actually govern. If we expand the base of young people, of black people, of Latinos and immigrants and LGBT people, we actually have a governing majority. We have a portion of people that will allow us to push things over the line. It's actually why we have really situated this podcast at not just the what and the how, and have specifically asked these candidates about how they will work with movements, not try to be our movement leader, but actually engage with and work with movement. And what is their history? Because that is going to be the power to actually make change happen. Elections are not about giving politicians jobs, but about making people's lives better. And so part of this is helping, wondering from these candidates how they will actually not just win an election, but make people's lives better. And unfortunately, there is a story that Democrats far too often tell themselves where they've got sort of this FOMO around this magical white voter that has long since left them. And if they don't sort of settle in on the sort of base of people who need to hear the things to be mobilized and motivated, we won't win the elections. And in fact, we will lose on a lot of things that people need us to win on.
Rashad Robinson, host of Voting While Black podcast and president of Color of Change. Thank you so much for being here with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, we are going to take a quick break. We have lots going on. We're talking a little Joe Biden when we come back. Stay with us.
Okay, we gotta talk about Joe Biden. So he's got some beliefs about what is likely to happen after the 2020 election, assuming he wins, that I have expressed concern about in the past, including the idea that there's gonna be this great reawakening and all these Republicans that lost their minds over the past few years are gonna suddenly become great people again, like they were before. That's a weird belief. It's not true. And if you actually think that's how things are gonna go, I don't trust you to get stuff done. But more recently, he said something that I find actually more concerning. So he was talking with BuzzFeed News. He says, it's not like there's going to be some great epiphany and people are going to wake up and go, oh my God, I'm now a Democrat. And if you hear people on the rope line saying I'm a Republican, I say, stay a Republican. Vote for me, but stay a Republican because we need a Republican Party. Okay, so far, kind of weird, but totally fine. That's not the end of the world, but we continue. Biden later added that he's concerned about what would happen if the Republican Party were totally, in his words, clobbered. I'm really worried that no party should have too much power. You need a countervailing force. Now look, I come by way of political science. I took some political theory courses. We can have a fun academic conversation about what would happen in America if the Democrats had all power for 100 years. That's not happening. It's not gonna happen anytime soon. Why is your concern that 2020 might be too harsh on the Republicans?
Also, right now, the Republican Party is led by an out racist. Mm-hmm. And all the people who are willing to follow him and fight for him and vote with him and support him, it is okay if in this dream world that we know would never happen, they all go. That's mm-hmm. actually what we should be hoping for. That's what we should be fighting for, not keeping people who are okay supporting a racist. No, yeah. we want there to be an imbalance of power when one side yes. is racist. That's what we want.
No, I think that people who don't murder people and murderers should be kept in balance at times.
What?
No, you.
This is like he's like making like the argument that like the president needs Congress to keep them in check.
Yes, there's supposed to be a balance of power between
the
branches.
We don't need a group of racists.
Yeah. And by the way, his concern, I get sort of where it's coming from. He believes that back in the 80s or the 90s or the 2000s or whatever, there were some good Republicans. And it really sucks to see that go away.
Yeah, like all voting and supporting for policies that overwhelmingly, disproportionately harmed black and brown people in America.
Yes, he was wrong. He was wrong.
They weren't Trump.
But even if he was right.
They weren't great policies for marginalized communities.
So he's concerned with, like, you know how like I don't want some norms to go away? One of his norms is that supposedly there's good Republicans and he doesn't want them to go away. Well, I got news for you, Joe. If that's actually what you want, if you want there to be two good choices for the American people, they can vote for the Democrats or the Republicans, and maybe some people go one way and then the next election they go the other way. The absolute best way to get to that is for the Republicans to be punched in the face so hard in 2020 that they actually have to do what they said they were gonna do the last time around. Back in 2012, they said, we're gonna have a postmortem, we're gonna figure out why is it that so many groups never wanna vote for us literally ever. They didn't do that. Instead, they doubled down on their white supremacy and they chose Donald Trump. We have a two-party system. If you actually come through academia like I do, you know, in a two-party system, you're never gonna have the Democrats winning for 150 years. The parties change, factions move, policies change, all of that. But that only happens when it has to happen.
Right.
If you keep having them like lingering and feeling like, well, if we can just get 2% more of old white voters to vote for us, then we don't have to change at all. That's not healthy for the Republican Party. It's not healthy for the American people. I have more that I could say, and we'll probably get to it, but we should probably take a break because Pete Buttigieg also needs some attention.
After
this. With concern growing over his closed door fundraiser policy, take a look at how Pete Buttigieg answers questions about whether this policy might change.
Mayor, earlier today you said you were open to having a conversation about opening your fundraisers, and that's a question that reporters have been asking for months now, so I'm wondering when do you expect to actually have that conversation and give like an answer on that?
Again, I don't have a timeline for you.
Well, Mayor, as the candidate, can't you just direct your campaign to open those fundraisers?
What's that?
As the candidate, can't you just direct your campaign to open those fundraisers?
Yes.
And why haven't you done so?
What's that?
Why haven't you done so yet?
There are a lot of considerations, and I'm thinking about it.
Last question. Can you give us an example of those considerations?
No.
Sorry.
What are you supposed to say to that?
That is,
I think the
Trump answer.
The only thing you can say is, who the do you think you are, Pete Buttigieg? That was one of the smuggest videos I've ever seen from a politician. Like I should have requested it. We have to zoom in on his face. We can't. But take a look at the little smile. Like, it's gonna take a little bit. I apologize. I didn't prep for this. This is my bad. This is my bad. But anyway, he's asked serious questions about whether there's undue influence behind the scenes by billionaires. And there's already many billionaires that are supporting Pete Buttigieg, which is noteworthy considering the fact that literally no one knew who he was 6 months ago.
Except for black people in South Bend. But
that's true. Yeah, exactly. So there's, I think, justifiable concern about that. Could he change it? Yes. Is he going to? There's considerations. Could you explain at all what those are? Nope. Because I don't have to. That's the unspoken part.
Yeah,
he's like, why would I be accountable?
And also, unfortunately, for someone who is running to be the president of the United States, being private about anything is never really seen as a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like someone being like not only am I keeping this behind closed doors, but I'm not even going to tell you why.
Yeah.
That's a double negative.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and look.
But he doesn't have to do anything. His entire, this like uplifting that he's had to prominence has been based on nothing. So he's rolling with that.
I would say devil's advocate, it's based on him sending the right signals that he is a potential replacement for Joe Biden. If you're worried that Sanders or Warren are too extreme and you just want to go back to 2015, but Buttigieg is doing what's necessary to make you think he'd do that.
No, because there are 94 candidates in between that. The only, like, you know why. It is not because people want a replacement that is not Bernie or Elizabeth Warren, but not Biden. Mm-hmm. That is Biden-like, but not them.
You don't think that's what it is?
I think that there would be 8 different people before you get to this person.
But I think there have been several other people.
This person has been uplifted to prominence mm-hmm. is because of what he looks like.
I agree. But I think probably a lot of the people that in the past month have started supporting Buttigieg, some of them were Harris supporters. Like, she jumped up for a while and then tailed off. It seemed like Warren went up, tailed off a little bit more, but she stayed a little bit higher. And Buttigieg came up, I think, taking some of the Warren and some of the Harris supporters.
That is just not what I see. I don't know.
Well, I can't say for sure. I'm looking at numbers move and trying to assume what's happening under the hood. But what I will say is, if you watch that video and you're a Buttigieg supporter, I have a game to play with you. What is a non-scary explanation for why he both doesn't want the closed-door fundraisers to end and refuses to say why he likes them so much? Is it because there's so many grassroots activists in there and he wants to maintain their privacy? No, that's not why. What are these millionaires and billionaires saying behind the scenes that he wants to make sure that you're not hearing? And more importantly, what is he saying to them that he does not want you to hear about?
Right, like, are they playing the secret recording that the police chief made in South Bend that we also can't know about?
There's a lot of stuff we can't know about.
What's happening behind these doors?
Yeah.
There's a lot, you know.
I get wanting to have some secrets, but when you're coming to this race with the least experience out of literally anyone there, hell, Marianne Williamson's published a bunch of books, that's something. You're coming in with almost no experience, no name recognition, and suddenly people are handing you millions of dollars, and you're spending it well. He spent like $4 million in Iowa and shot up by a number of points there. But what is actually underneath all that?
Oh my gosh, people in Iowa, oh my, wow.
We don't know why. We're sending a person.
Wow.
We're gonna try to figure it out.
I'm just saying, wow.
But money can buy you some support. But anyway, my overall point, and I tweeted something to this effect of seeing that video without him going on TV today and explaining what that was about. And also another video, we can't show, there's music playing, we can't play it. A kid asked him if he would stop taking money from millionaires and billionaires. He said no, and he walked away. Like, as fast and as dismissive as I just acted or whatever. It's disqualifying. In this cycle, where we care so much about having the right candidate, we cannot have someone with the smugness of Donald Trump with the unearned confidence and hell, unearned support of Donald Trump, honestly.
Listen, when you show people how to treat you, they treat you like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, disqualifying. He has to explain this. He has to, and if you support him, you're entitled to. I'm sure there's something you like about him. You need to start thinking about it because there are other candidates and they might deserve your trust a little bit more. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, documents revealing a nearly 2-decade-long campaign of lies in Afghanistan after this. Okay, pretty much everyone gets at this point that the war in Afghanistan was a disaster in virtually every way that a foreign conflict could be. But now, as a result of a pretty in-depth investigation, we're finding out more and more about the campaign of deception that was employed by the US government and the US military over almost 2 decades to make sure that it took as long as possible for us to discover just how bad it was. We're talking here about a Washington Post investigation. There's a write-up by Craig Whitlock. They used more than 2,000 pages of unpublished notes of interviews, some going back years and years and years, more than 400 insiders, many of them anonymous, but some of them not anonymous, being willing to criticize the war effort in Afghanistan in a more open way than I believe I've seen before. So I want to give you some examples of this. This first quote comes from a 3-star Army general, Douglas Loot. It says, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing. What are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking." And what's interesting is that you have a combination of two things. You have a lack of understanding of the history, the social dynamics, the factions in Afghanistan, with an ever-expanding list of priorities, goals, missions. They use an analysis at one point, a metaphor, of there's this Christmas tree, and they said there are presents under there for everyone. And those presents are a goal we have in terms of our foreign policy. And so we went in with one goal, and as soon as we got there, nobody knew how to pursue that one, and so they just started to proliferate. We got a lot more we're gonna get to, but I wanted your initial reaction.
Well, this is not shocking. I think this is kind of what it looked like on the outside.
Chaotic and ignorant and yeah.
Way too long.
Way too long, way too costly. Let's transition to the cost. So in terms of lives, Luke continued, this is the 3-star Army General, says, if the American people knew the magnitude of this dysfunction, 2,400 lives lost, who will say this was in vain? And that's one of the things too. As it got worse and worse, there was less and less of an ability or willingness to acknowledge how bad it was getting. And nobody wanted to tank their career by being the one general to point out that there was no, that the mission made no sense, the spending priorities made no sense. And so let's talk more about the deaths. Since 2001, more than 775,000 US troops deployed to Afghanistan, many of them multiple times. 2,300 died there, over 20,000 were wounded, but the deaths go far beyond that. Look at this little graph showing over 60,000 deaths of Afghan security forces, over 40,000 Afghan civilians. You see Taliban fighters and insurgents at over 40,000. You're seeing dozens of journalists and media workers, hundreds of humanitarian aid workers, NATO and coalition troops from other countries, contractors, and all of that. Actually, the US military personnel, while it's absolutely devastating that over 2,000 died, is one of the smaller groups there overall. And these, by the way, are US military numbers for these. So understand that they're unlikely to be overestimates, but there's a good chance they're underestimates, especially for civilian casualties.
Yeah, my only thing is like none of this is surprising. And the fear, I think, for a lot of people for decades, even before this, is that this has always kind of been the story and that we haven't learned from this.
So I guess the fear would then be that if people didn't take away the right lessons from the war in Afghanistan, that they might be more likely to land us in a conflict that could have similar results.
Exactly.
And especially when the invasion was not pitched as, oh, by the way, in two decades, we're still gonna have a significant military force there. And so look, I don't think necessarily that if they were to say, hey, Iran, let's do what we did to Iraq, I don't think a lot of Americans would sign on to that. But the American people have a level of trust in our elected representatives when it comes to war that I don't think is earned. And a willingness to be dragged along into a mission that's far broader in time and money and lives lost than it's initially pitched as.
That's been chipped away, like that trust, don't you think?
I hope so. I think that Iraq was really damaging to that. To politicians and military contractors that are looking for endless war, I think that they went too far for their own personal interests.
When it was fake over or when it was, like what part do you think was most damaging?
What do you mean?
When it was pretend over, or then when it was like actually?
Just the sheer length. I think people got ground down by it.
Yeah.
And I think, look, I also want to talk about the money too, because obviously the lives lost are devastating, but the cost is significant as well. And we can never let people forget how much money was wasted, not just in Afghanistan. Iraq was obviously even bigger, but a lot of money in Afghanistan. So let's talk about that. Since 2001, the Defense Department, State Department, and US Agency for International Development spent or appropriated between $934 billion and $978 billion. That does not include money spent by other agencies such as the CIA and the VA. And of course, it's interesting that they leave out the VA money because that's obviously gigantic already, but that's money that will continue being spent for literally decades. We've created health disastrous health outcomes for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of individuals that we will be paying for the rest of our lives. That by far is the most justified expense. If we're gonna send people over there, we definitely have to take care of them. But they don't factor that in. When they're pitching you on going to war, they never say, hey, by the way, in 40 years, we're still gonna be paying for this. And so it's easy to discount it. Now, also in terms of the spending, let's see. That's really important. I wanna go back to the beginning. I'm gonna jump ahead a little bit. Because there's some quotes here from Don Rumsfeld from really early on, from the initial invasion, that are fascinating, especially in hindsight now knowing what we know. So back on April 17th, 2002, 6 months after the war started, he wrote, I may be impatient. In fact, I know I'm a bit impatient. We are never going to get the US military out of Afghanistan unless we take care to see that there is something going on that will provide the stability that will be necessary for us to leave. Help, with an exclamation point. That was 6 months in. We're 17 years plus later than that.
Yeah.
He says, I have no visibility into who the bad guys are. We are woefully deficient in human intelligence. That was September 2003. They didn't know. It was complicated then. It got more complicated almost constantly.
That's terrifying.
He wrote help with an exclamation point.
Yeah.
Okay, unfortunately, we don't have any more time. I wish that we could go on. Definitely go to the Washington Post, take a look at it. Craig Whitlock, great write-up, lots of information. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having
me. Great to have you here. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Lots planned for this week, so we will see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.